You're listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast, a product of the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association. To learn more, visit our website at or.nhsbca.org. Welcome to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. I'm Derek Tuman, OBCA Vice President and Boys Basketball Coach at West Albany High School. Today, I'm joined by Craig Ellington, retired girls basketball coach and athletic director from Crescent Valley High School. Coach, how are you doing today?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to us. We really appreciate it. Coach, I want to jump in first for those that might not be familiar with you. Can you give us a little bit of background information on kind of your coaching and education journey? How did you get into coaching, and how did you end up as the longtime girls coach at Crescent Valley?
Well, I went to high school in Tacoma, Washington, at Wilson High School. I played for Dan Enveen there. I was a very mediocre high school player who had just a real passion. It was a huge – my graduating class had over 800 students, and so three grades, we had about 2,500 students in the high school. So it was just a great experience, though. I, in high school, and my passion as a role player was fun. It gave me a perspective, which I think really helped me down the line. I graduated from Wilson and then went to Washington State, and I was asked to coach the ninth grade, or assist the ninth grade team at Pullman High School, where I had John Elway on my on the team, and then in the summers, my high school coach asked me to come back and coach the high school teams in the summer back in Tacoma, and I graduated from Washington State in 1977, and in the fall of 1977, I landed a job at Crescent Valley High School, where I was the boys' JV coach for 4 years under Bill Wold. And after 4 years, Eileen and Molly, who I had in class, came to me, and the girls' coach had resigned, and they asked me if I'd be interested. I hadn't never thought about coaching girls, and they had two great kids, pretty good players, and I thought, you know, why not? So I applied, and I got the job and for girls, and my girls coaching started in 1982 at Crescent Valley.
That's awesome. And then, for those that don't know, you were there for quite a while, and then you stepped away to become athletic director, correct?
I did. I stepped away twice. My son was born, I just coached girls for 2 years and stepped away for 2 years and then came back, coached for a long time, and then I became the athletic director in the fall of 2001 and then was asked to come back. I stepped away for like 10 years then and came back as the girls coach again. I was a varsity coach. I'm really bad with this, but 24, 25 years, something like that, at Crescent Valley.
Coach, I think, you know, you got to coach John Elway as a freshman. I think what we all want to know is, did he choose the right sport in football, or would he have been as good of a basketball player?
He chose the right sport. He was good. I mean, he was quite an athlete, obviously. But it was an amazing ninth grade team, unbelievable team, talented. And he wasn't our best basketball player, that's for sure, but he was good. So
yeah. I would imagine. Very cool. You know, you talked about a little bit, the girls came and talked you into maybe a little bit applying and getting that girls job. As someone who was coaching boys and then kind of jumping in on the girls side, what was kind of the biggest either surprise or thing that you weren't really prepared for going from coaching boys to coaching girls?
I think with girls, you don't have to overcoach them. that was it's initially when I first got it, I felt like with boys, I really overcoached. I was, you know, real direct, and with girls, it was more, I don't want to say more coachable, but they were, you know, they were more attentive to this is what I want you to do, and they would try to do it. Where with guys, it felt like I had to be real direct. And I remember being direct in the very first game. Kim Bolt was her name, and she was giving up the baseline, and we at the time didn't give it up and tried not to. And I just was real direct with her, and you know, there was tears, and it really hit me hard that first game that, okay, this is different, and I need to adjust to it right away. So, and I felt like I tried at least.
Right. So obviously, Coach, since you started, you know, in the profession, the game's changed quite a bit. How have you kind of seen the game change since when you started in the early 80s to where it is now?
You know, when I first started, we were running a lot of what we called passing game, which is kind of pass and go away and set a pick. And so to me, it's similar to, you know, we had a lot of five out, but you know, wasn't really posting up people at the time. And then I really went to triangle and really kind of tried to put the ball inside, start there, and then bring it back out if they just collapse so much. But now I feel like it's, you know, it's five out, four out, or, you know, read and react. And it's a lot of everyone's handling the ball. And that's a huge change that I didn't adjust to well, because I kind of resisted going to that. But it's certainly popular and effective for a lot of people.
Yeah, when you watch high school games now, are there some things that you watch and you're like, man, you know, kids are really lacking this, or they should be, you know, doing this a little bit more?
You know, I guess I don't watch it that way. When I go to a game now, I probably watch coaches and kind of study what they're doing more than anything, but try not to be real critical of especially a high school kid. I'm somewhat amazed at some of their skill level, and especially ball handling. I just, you know, I remember, you know, I used to tell my big kids that, hey, you get to dribble twice and then you pick it up and go and find a guard. You know, I don't want you. Now it's just like, I'm amazed at how well they can handle it and also shoot. You know, I've seen girls that handle the ball really well and shoot from everywhere. So I'm impressed by that. But it's a real change for sure, for me at least.
Yeah. When you took your second hiatus to become the athletic director, and then you came back, how did your perspective after being an athletic director change how you coached?
I think as athletic director, I really enjoyed that job, and part of it was I really enjoyed watching other coaches and within a program, you know, the Crescent Valley program, and just to see how they handled kids, how they handled parents, how they handled everything. And that was really good for me to see what other coaches were doing, and at other schools also, and to talk to other ADs. I think I learned quite a bit just observing other coaches. And then I think my biggest perspective change was the parents. My perspective with parents was really changed, because I interacted with them quite a bit more as an AD than I did as a coach. And I really believe most of them are there for the same reason, and they want what we want. And I think we hear from the negative ones, and that's where coaches kind of shut down a little bit, because, but most of them are I think, very supportive and great. And you can get a lot from them, and they can help a program quite a bit, I think.
Were there any policies or things that you used to do that you changed when you came back? So maybe how you dealt with parents or how you worked with your assistant coaches, things like that. Do you remember anything that maybe you specifically changed after being AD to when you took over the head job again?
Yeah, I was definitely more standoffish with parents, and that changed. I wasn't as much. Now, I'm not saying they were all, you know, happy and everything was great, but for the most part, they would do any, you know, if you treat their kids, you know, right, and they understand sometimes they're incredibly biased, and I'm a parent, I'm biased, I understand that, but I think that was my biggest change from before when I was coaching. I really put up a wall and just said, you know, I don't really want to talk to you, you know. I didn't really want to talk to them. And that was a mistake on my part, I believe.
Yeah. Did you do anything to engage parents? You know, were there things that you did to reach out to them, to bring them into your program? Or was it just you became more approachable if they wanted to talk to you?
Well, I wouldn't say, and they probably wouldn't, some of them would think we wasn't that approachable. But I would go to them. I there was a few that, you know, like I remember one. I bought that The Role of a Parent with Bruce Brown. I don't know if you've ever seen it, but it's really good. Mm-hmm. And I bought like 10 of those CDs. And if I had a parent that was just, you know, all over the officials and all over their daughter or whatever, I remember one, without mentioning any names, I more than once gave him the CD and said, I want you to listen to this and let's talk about it after you listen to it. I want to know what you think, if you agree or not. And I had parents write me notes saying, I release my child to you from this day forward. It changed them. And I'm not kidding. It really did change them. And where their daughter was enjoying it a lot more, and so were they. And, you know, I had one mom say it saved their marriage because she just couldn't handle sitting next to him as he was yelling at their daughter and yelling at the officials and just how much that hurt her game and how much she was taken away from his daughter's experience. So in that way, I would, you know, and I never had someone say, no, that's terrible. I don't agree with that ever. But it in that way, I was a lot more probably proactive to really sit down and just say, hey, you and I want the same thing for your daughter, but you're not going about it the way that's going to work, in my opinion. So here's something for you to listen to.
Yeah. Did you feel, I mean, I think that's a great idea. I think that all coaches, you know, young coaches, any coach really, to try to engage parents in that way. Did you feel like at first parents resisted that at all, or were they open to, you know, this idea of listening to this CD and kind of buying into what it was talking about?
Well, I think if you go to them and say, hey, you need to change. My approach was, I want you to listen to this and tell me what you think. And, you know, some would say, yeah, it was good, you know, but that doesn't really apply to me. Well, in my opinion, it did apply to them. And I think the seed was planted and maybe down the road or, you know, but most of them, it wasn't like I handed it to all of them. You know, some of our coaches at Crescent Valley made all parents in a preseason meeting watch it and listen to that about the role of the parent, which was just basically release your child to the sport and to the coach. And, you know, and that doesn't mean your coach gets to do whatever they want, but, you know, you just let them enjoy it and just release it, and it just makes it so much better, as every coach knows, you know. So because if they're looking at mom or dad in the stands during a game, it's not going to work, you know. So it's just not good. It's really hard on their child.
Yeah. One of the things I know head coaches have to do, and you kind of talked about being an AD, getting to see other coaches and how they work in their programs. But one of the things that I've heard you did a really good job of is kind of developing your assistant coaches, making them feel valued and improving their craft. So was there anything in particular that you would try to do to help your assistants improve and kind of give them ownership in your program?
Oh, that's a nice thing to say. I felt so fortunate with the assistants I had over the years. I had many great assistants, and Oregon State was such a great place to get some young ones. And the facility, Crescent Valley's facility, is so nice because the three courts being right there. So we practice at the same time. And we bring the whole program together to teach. And so I know one thing I really tried to do, and it was hard for younger assistants especially, but I tell them, you're going to be doing some teaching, and not just to the freshman or JV group, but the varsity kids too. And this is a program where, and I started with, you know, you're going to teach your favorite drill, whatever, if it was from high school or college, wherever. A new drill, and you're going to teach it and show it to all of us. And just getting them more comfortable, and also coaching the varsity kids, which then the varsity kids, I think, really responded, especially to the new drill. They liked it, you know, and a young coach. And then I think that's how it got started. And then as they learn our system, I had them, you know, try to teach some of that too, and just so it wasn't always me being the only one talking. I think that was real important. And like I said, though, I had assistants that were varsity coaches, and then I had assistants that were freshmen in college, and I had some former players that knew our system very well and could teach anything really what we were trying to do. But I have been very fortunate to have great assistants over the years.
Yeah. How about as an athletic director? I'm kind of curious, you know, every AD is a little bit different, but what did you do, you know, even in sports where maybe you weren't as well-versed, or what were some things that you did to help coaches improve, or what advice maybe would you give them to help them develop their craft?
The varsity coaches?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think we spent a lot of time, you know, as AD with varsity coaches and let them, I didn't try to micromanage their assistants unless I saw something with an assistant that, you know, or heard something said that I thought was very inappropriate or whatever, and then I would intervene and say something. But I think just through coaches meetings, we call them awards nights, fall, you know, winter and spring, and not many schools have that anymore. But one thing I added is, and the coaches were resistant to this at first, but back to kind of parents, that gave a feedback form where every player, every person that walked in the auditorium got the program, and also there was a feedback form for their program, their coach, and I asked 10 questions that I thought were like our core values, what was important, and then I let them write, and I thought it was going to be positive, and it was. It ended up being, you know, you heard from those parents that never said anything that were just happy. And then I read them all. And if there was a concerning, if there was something that, you know, I heard quite a few times, and it was concerning, then the coach and I would sit down and talk about it one-on-one. But 95% of the time, it was nothing but positive. And those coaches started, I think, looking forward to getting those. At first, they didn't want them, because I think, but then they started getting just great feedback and positive feedback. So it was, it ended up being a positive, I believe, from my perspective. So that was just one way, but it's kind of a segue for me to talk to them about good and bad things that maybe that I heard. There were some that I just threw out. They were just so ridiculous, but they never even saw those, but because they were just not true. So
right. Yeah. No, I like it. That's great. I think as coaches, we don't want the feedback because we're so used to it being negative, right? Just like
exactly.
Right? They don't want to continue. But like you're saying, the parents that aren't saying anything are probably okay or even happy with how things are going.
Right. It got to the point where parents would type up, you know, what they wanted to say in a letter, and instead of mm-hmm. writing it out that night, they would just, and I had a box for them to, you know, they most of them signed them, but not all, but they would then just take their typed letter and put it in there, because I told them, I'm going to read every one of them, and I'm going to give them to the coach, the head coach. And so they knew eventually, most of them were thank you to the coaches for everything you've done. And then they would give specific examples of how they impacted their child. So I think it was a real positive. And it also gave parents an opportunity to voice both positive and negative if they wanted to.
Absolutely. Awesome. All right. We're going to take a quick break. We'll return with more from Coach Ellingson right after this on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
The start of school means it's time to sign up or renew your Oregon Basketball Coaches Association membership. OBCA membership includes access to exclusive resources that help personalize instruction, understand players' mindsets, and maximize the impact of your practices. Members also receive access to the OBCA mentoring program and have a voice in improving the game at the state level. Membership starts at just $15 a year. Register online today at or.nhsbca.org.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Derek Duman here, speaking with Coach Craig Ellingson. Coach, thinking back to when you were the head coach of the CV girls, how did you measure success in your program, and what did that look like?
Well, it varied from year to year, and I sat down with our entire, you know, varsity team after that was set, but before we started competing, and we set three goals, and in order of importance. Number one was a GPA goal for our team. We're there to go to school, and I had every kid tell me, you know, what their goal for the first semester, what their goal would be for their GPA. And then we actually listed them, and then a team goal, GPA. And we really tried to emphasize that on a regular basis of being our goal. So that was, and that goal was always very high. It was like, you know, right around a three, anywhere from a 3.8 to a 3.9 something. I think it was good just to put that on them that, you know, and I said, if you have to miss practice, you shouldn't have to if you're doing this right, but if you do to get that goal and you have something, okay. But that didn't happen very often, but it did happen a few times. The second part of our goal was just right around the school's code of conduct and that we're going to follow that and then be specific about how we're going to respect people and property and what that looks like. we're going to respect our opponent no matter what the score is, you know, and we're going to respect our and the property wherever we're at on a bus or another person's gym or wherever. And then the last one was a win-loss where we thought we'd end up kind of at the my teams were really competitive at the state level. We ended up setting, it seemed like the ultimate goal for us was to win a game on the last day of the season. Whatever that game was, if it was the state championship, that was our goal. If it was for third place, we wanted to win that game. And I think that really helped us because we had a few of those where we played for third. And I saw so many teams just disappointed, you know, because they weren't going to make it to the state championship. And I felt like we could really, hey, here's our goal. You know, that hasn't changed. And I felt like that little thing really seemed to keep them focused on what we were trying to do. But we never really set like win league championships very often, you know, but we tried to set what our end goal was. And so that was the three as a team. And then we did every game goals. We had, you know, how many turnovers were allowed, you know, our offensive rebound, and all those goals. We set those for every game. And then I put them up in the team room for every game. And we kind of saw how we tried to improve as the year went on. So
those game goals, were those the same from year to year, or did those fluctuate depending on the team you had?
They fluctuated, and I tried real hard. Some of them remained the same, you know, just, you know, shoot like 70% from the free throw line, shoot 50% from the field or something like that, 50% or higher. But depending on your skill level and your talent level, you know, I wanted to make it kind of like that old saying, it's a dream with a deadline. What would make you really happy? You know, what would you feel really good about? And for some teams it was different than others. And I had teams that it was to win that last day. And that was kind of exciting. Other teams to get there would be the goal, to get to the state tournament or to get to the state playoffs, you know, so and make that a successful season. I think it's kind of a waste of time to say, oh, it's to win the state championship every year. It's just not realistic. So, I personally think you should keep it high, but also keep it realistic.
Yeah. How did you go about, or did you have a philosophy, I guess as an AD as well, maybe, behind preseason scheduling, right? I mean, if you had a better team, were you going to schedule tougher? How did you kind of prepare for who your non-league games would be based on the talent level of your team?
I definitely tried to schedule really every year higher than, you know, talent than we were. My best team was a year we played Glencoe, who was ranked like 12th in the nation, and Oregon City, who was ranked number one in the nation. And we were good, but they were our first two games, and they just destroyed us. And it was great because we, you know, okay, this is where we got a whole season to get, because we're going to see these folks again. And we did. We saw both of them again at the state tournament. And I just think it's again, from year to year, trying to be realistic about that, but not getting teams that you can just destroy. I don't see any purpose in that, for sure. Yeah.
Switching gears a little bit here, Coach, I want to talk about some basketball-specific type stuff. You talked about a little bit in the first segment, post-play, and how maybe you were a little resistant to getting players out of the post once you got them in there. You know, talking to different coaches and having gotten to coach against you for a year, I've always thought, you know, you I thought your post play was pretty tough, tough to defend, and they were well-skilled and fundamental. Can you talk about, you know, how you taught kids to play in the post, and what were some of the things that you found led to success?
Sure. I my first time I took a break for 2 years when my son was born, and I kind of went and watched some games, and I didn't really know him very well, but Mark Neffendorf was at Glencoe running Barry's stuff and triangle, and I just couldn't believe how tough his posts were, and they weren't very big, and they weren't, I mean, I just sat there, and I was just in awe of it, and again, I didn't know him very well, but like what you're doing here, it's really, this is what I think is so great about Oregon, at least, is I called him, and I said, I'm going to get back into coaching, and I'd really like to talk to you. And he came down to Corvallis with his wife, actually, and had dinner, and then he and I sat down for a few hours, and he went over everything. And then I kept calling him, and really, I give it Mark's. Mark taught me. Mark was my mentor. We're the same age, but he really taught me a lot of basketball, and we're friends because of it, and just over the years, just sharing stuff, and we had to play each other state tournaments and you know, other times, but it was hard because he definitely is the person who introduced me to triangle, and it's just all fundamental work, and you know, it all ties together as far as teaching your guards to read defenses and to get the ball in the right position, and but it's really broken down. It takes a lot of work, I think, to do it right. And Mark had it broken down, and he didn't hold back in sharing how to do it. And so it was great. Actually, I enjoyed teaching it.
Yeah. How did you balance the, you know, having to work so much on those fundamentals, and spending time on that versus trying to do more team stuff, right? Making sure that you're ready for a 2-2-1 press or a 1-3-1 trapping defense, right? It's one of the battles coaches face a lot. So how did you kind of, you know, tackle that issue of working on those fundamentals while also getting your team ready for whatever they might face?
Well, it's, you know, times have changed so much where it used to be November 1st or, you know, first Monday in November, and you had so much more time. And I personally, preseason used to be just formal practice for me, you know, but with power rankings, that's changed that too. So, I mean, I really felt like I had 2 months, November, December, and then league would start after winter break and in January. So it's really has changed. And I think that's unfortunate because it kind of forces maybe coaches to have to spend more time out of season to do those fundamental work, and then come back and just do team stuff during season. And that's because kids tend to have to get it somewhere. But I felt like I had enough time, and then when you went to preseason games, you could really use film to show it, what we were doing or what we weren't doing fundamentally. And I coached most of the time. I had the time. I felt like wasn't in a big rush. I was in for that first league game. That's what I was. That's where it started for me as far as, okay, we got to be ready by that game.
Yeah. How about on the defensive side of the ball, Coach? We've talked a little bit about offense and some stuff there, but you know, talking to different coaches, and in my research, it always seemed like you had a wrinkle on defense, or you'd throw something out there that maybe coaches weren't prepared for or hadn't seen before. So what was kind of your philosophy behind that, and how did you make sure your kids were ready to do those different things?
Well, I think for me, like what you just mentioned too, I felt like I'm gonna teach multiple defenses because I have no idea what this team going to throw at me, you know. So I better be ready for, you know, half court trap or triangle and two or full court zone, full court and run and jump, whatever. And so we did have quite a few variables, and I didn't want to just, hey, this team sometimes does a half court trap, you know, and so we work on it for 5 minutes and run it poorly to try to simulate it. But so I tried to have a little bit of everything that we could actually use. And I also felt like it was effective, you know, at the beginning of another quarter, or just to throw, I'll back up, if we were playing, whoever we were playing, we always had a primary defense from scouting or film that we thought would work against them. And then, so kids knew, okay, our primary defense this time is going to be a 2-3 zone. And then we'd call out other things just for one possession. And they'd know the primary, unless I changed the primary zone or primary defense, the others were just one time. And sometimes it worked and sometimes it didn't, but we changed defenses at free throw situations. And so we were always changing, and it sometimes caused some confusion because out of a timeout, you know how coaches are, we all like to run something out of a timeout. Well, you weren't sure what we were going to be in. And so it would change, you know, all of a sudden it's like, oh, we ran this against a zone or whatever. And they changed up. So that was my thinking. It sometimes backfired too. So.
Yeah. How'd you get your kids to be able to do that? You know, obviously you have your primary defense. You're probably going to practice that week.
Yes.
In those two games. But, you know, to be able to kind of do that on the fly, right? Like, hey, we're going to go to 1-3-1 on this possession, and then the next free throw you're going to, you know, maybe a full court. You know, were kids confused at all, or how did you kind of keep that confusion to a minimum?
I'm sure at times I had some incredibly smart kids. And, you know, I think by the time they're on varsity, if your program, you know, the younger teams, we called it five defense. It's man to man, but we called it five. That's what they ran. And, you know, then as the season went on, maybe they put in, you know, one other thing. So it's a progressive thing. And we had a primary, you know, they would run a primary zone and five. And that was it. And so just over time, I don't really think there was confusion because everything was numbered. So we'd call it out too. And our kids on the floor would call it out, whatever the number was. And combination of numbers for a full court press dropping into a different, you know, half court. So I guess just practice over time. Again, back to that, I had 2 months. And
right.
And I think they were, and maybe that's how it's really changed. You don't have the time to do that kind of stuff. I don't know.
Yeah. Is there a game that you look back on in your career where you just, it makes you smile, you remember it fondly, or someone asks you what your favorite game would be? Do you have one?
Yes and no. It was hard. It was Glencoe and Mark. We played them in preseason, and they took it to us up at their place pretty good. And then we played them in the state tournament. To make it to the semis, we had to beat them, and that was a huge upset. It was one of those games where if we played 10 times, I think they would have won 9 of them. They were really good. And I really think he's an amazing coach and does an amazing job. So I was proud of our kids, but that one, it was also hard for me because he is a friend. And I know how much he had done for me. So
yeah.
But that's one I look back on probably.
How about the flip side? Is there a game maybe you look back and you're like, ah, I wish I had that one back?
Well, there's this guy down at Thurston that took it to me pretty good. That one, that one I want back. So, They probably are just losses that you just feel like, you know how it is. It's tough. You know, you learn so much from it though, you know, and you just, I don't know how you are, but for me, it was always, I wanted to, I'd like to play them again tomorrow and do this and do that just to try something different. That's what I love about league. You get to play twice, and I think right. That's kind of a fun thing. So,
yeah,
but nothing really sticks out as, I wasn't a very good loser. I'll put it that way.
Yeah, I don't think many of us are, Coach. I think that's one of the ones. Sometimes even when we win, you know, it's hard to enjoy it because you're thinking of all the things you didn't do well, right? You're just excited to get to practice the next day.
Yeah,
for sure. What advice would you have for young coaches that are just entering the coaching ranks?
I think looking back when I was young, I took everything very personally, you know, and I wish I would have learned at a younger age, because I think the AD job really taught me that, and to not take it personally, and whether it be a parent or even a kid or whoever, you know, if it's their perspective, and it's you know, it's where they're coming from, and for you to then turn it and make it personal, I think would be my advice I'd give a young person. I wish I would have been more like not taking things so personal when I was young.
Mm-hmm. How about as an AD, maybe for coaches that are applying for maybe their first head coaching job or even another head coaching job, you have any advice from an AD's perspective?
I think to make sure it's student centered, that they're, you know, I really want to know they care, and that looks differently. I look at coaches, and I always am looking at a coach and say, I'd really like for my son or daughter to be coached by them. And I think that's when you don't, and they don't have to look alike. Matter of fact, I didn't want all the coaches at Crescent Valley to be alike. I didn't want clones to, this is how we're all going to do it. And I thought it was really valuable for kids to go to different coaches and see a different style. But I did want to make sure those coaches cared. And I want kids to know that coach cares, about them. They might do it a different way, but that's how I tried to do it as an AD and try to coach coaches about what that looks like or it didn't look like in a certain situation.
All right, good stuff, Coach. We're going to take another break. When we return, Coach Ellington will try to beat the shot clock here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast.
Stay up to date with the Oregon Basketball Coaches Association on social media at facebook.com/OregonBCA or on Twitter at @OrHoopCoaches.
Welcome back to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. We're talking with Craig Ellingson, retired girls basketball coach and athletic director from Crescent Valley High School. Coach, for my next set of questions, I'm going to put you up against the shot clock. Here's how it works. I'm going to put 35 seconds on a timer, and I'm going to ask you some rapid-fire questions that are about basketball, some about sports, some about coaching. And they should be 1 to 2 word answers is kind of our goal. So we're trying to go quick here, Coach. And then if there's anything you want to expound on when we're done, we can follow up and give a more in-depth response, at that time. Sound good?
Sounds good.
All righty. We're going to put 35 seconds on the timer and we are starting now. Do you think Oregon High School basketball should have a shot clock?
Why? No.
if you're up with 3 points with less than 10 seconds on the clock, do you foul?
No.
What's your favorite way to guard on-ball screens?
Depends where it's at.
What's your favorite sports movie?
Boy, that's a tough one. Rudy.
You have a favorite coaching book?
I have quite a few, so no, I don't.
How did you celebrate after a big win?
Usually we'd go to dinner either as a team or a coaching staff.
What's one word officials would have used to describe you?
Obnoxious.
Time. Well done. That's a good one, Coach. I haven't heard that one yet. Obnoxious. I like it. I like it. So, I call it the shot clock segment. It's just kind of a fun way to ask you some different questions and get through a lot of content. But as you probably are aware, you know, the shot clock is kind of a hot topic issue, both in our state and across the country. You had mentioned that you didn't think we maybe needed a shot clock yet. You want to expound and explain why you think that?
Well, my teams, we either turned it over or shot it within 30 seconds. Without question. So I guess for me, it really, I think changes the game in a huge way. And I guess I'm a guy that's been at the same school for 42 years, so I'm not a big change guy. And I see it as changing the game quite a bit. And I'm not sure why. What do you think is the main argument for having one?
Yeah, I think it makes the game a little more upbeat. I mean, like you're saying, most teams will get a shot off without having to need it, right? But there are games and times, I think, you know, recently in, I want to say it was Alabama, they had a playoff game that ended with a score of 6-4, right? Mm. So a team held the ball the whole game. And, the famous – made national news. I think it was Willamette played Springfield.
I was there.
Willamette held the ball. And, you know, it was strategically, right, that was what they needed to do. But it was one of those where I think, you know, the argument for it is, you know, it gets kids playing a little more, right? You can't sit and hold the basketball. I think the end of the game becomes a little more exciting, right? So instead of holding for one shot for the last minute, you know, you might have a 2-for-1 situation there, where you don't have to foul to get the ball back, right? You can get a stop. There's a variety of opinions on both sides. You know, personally, I'm in favor of it. I don't think the game would change that much, but I do think it would change for the better. I think it rewards defense. Which I think is hard enough to get kids to buy in on the defensive end nowadays.
Right.
You know, they all want to shoot and stuff, and which is great. I want them to shoot too, but you know, if you can get your team to buy in for 35 seconds, I feel
right.
on the defensive
right.
end.
As a coach, I could see that. I could see where it'd be a positive. As an AD, it's, and I'm sure I wouldn't be alone on this, that you have a person that's going to have that's going to be a big job for someone.
Right.
Because we had a tough enough time having a person just hitting a switch to stop the clock or start it, you know, and all of a sudden you have to have someone that's really focused, I think,
right.
to run that. So that would be one concern at the high school level, I think. But, you're probably right. It's worth trying, probably.
Right.
I know I traveled enough with teams where we went to states that had it, and it didn't really impact us. So I guess I wouldn't really be bothered by it.
Right. Yeah. Coach, you mentioned you had some favorite books that you really enjoyed. What are some recommendations that you have for coaches?
You know, some of them are so old. When I first started the boys coach, my second year at Crescent Valley, he retired and he gave me all his books, and I just went through them and I read them. And I couldn't believe how many he had, but, I just, I've read every year when I was coaching, definitely in the off season, I would try to read as much as possible. But a lot of them were technique type books, you know. So, and I still have some of the books, but to get one out and just, I probably couldn't really just name just one.
Mm-hmm. That's fair. Coach, how did you go about selecting your team captains?
Oh, that changed for me over the years. And I decided late in my career, because so few kids, it seems like, went through the program for 4 years and then you had seniors. I don't know if it's that way for you, but it seemed like I had four seniors every year, four, maybe five or whatever, and sometimes a few more, sometimes less. And so I decided, you know, I think it's partly my responsibility to teach kids how to lead. And mm-hmm. so I said, you're a senior, you're a captain. And we didn't vote. That's just the way it is. Because I really believe in high school setting at that age that seniors are kind of your leaders anyway. And your year is somewhat dictated by your senior group. And so I felt I'm going to put them in that role, and it's my job, just like to teach them basketball skills, is to teach them leadership skills of what that looks like. And as AD, I actually started a leadership class for all of our athletes, and I did it for the season, you know, late in my AD career. I thought this it was great for me. I enjoyed it because I got them without coaching, and then I got to, you know, really know some kids on other teams, and I really enjoyed that part of it, to be able to go to their games and you know that I knew some of them at least. And mm-hmm. so anyway, that seemed to work for me, and I felt, not always, but I just felt it was my responsibility to teach kids that, because they're going to lead something at some point in their life, probably,
right,
whether be their family or whatever. And what's, you know, what's effective leadership with integrity look like? And so I that my philosophy definitely changed.
Yeah, what were some of maybe those key points? Obviously, you know, you taught a whole class on it, and we don't have quite that much time, but what were some of the, what's the Cliff Notes version, Coach? What were some of the key things that you emphasized in that leadership class?
Well, just what that, you know, we gave situations and what that looked like, and you know, what do leaders do as far as in a coaching situation, and you know, you're the communication between the team and myself. I'm not always, especially, you know, if I'm coaching girls, I'm not in the locker room, you know, a lot. So that they are. And what are you going to do if something happens in that locker room that shouldn't be happening, and or on a bus or somewhere else? And what's that look like? And it's not always easy. And what about the, you know, what are you going to do for that kid that's, you know, the girl that's just not happy with the way things are going? How are you going to handle that? And, you know, it was more of a situation. And then I had them, you know, kind of, I split them up into, you know, one from each team every season as a group, and they would discuss that and come back and kind of come up with what they thought was important. And then I also gave them the idea of how to do goals and be part of that, setting goals for their teams and things like that. And then they would go back, set their goals, and bring them back to the whole group. So they shared their goals with all the other teams.
Yeah. Cool. That's awesome. I like that a lot. Coach, did you have a favorite team bonding activity you'd like to do with the girls?
I thought it was, at some point, for various reasons, but traveling was good. To go, whether it be in the summer, to travel somewhere, or in you know, at a tournament. We went to Gillette, Wyoming quite a few times, actually, during the winter. Twice had to bus all the way home because the snow was so bad. But just an amazing tournament, how the hosts there were incredible. And then, like, we went to Juneau one winter. Again, we had to sleep in an airport on the way home. But that kind of stuff is, you know, it was life memories that were great. And I also thought, at the time we were going to Portland for the state tournament, it was good to travel and learn that you know what it was like to stay in a hotel and have to compete. And we talk about that. You know, we're preparing hopefully for state tournament where you're traveling and staying or something. So, but yeah. It was a great team bonding thing too.
For sure. How about a favorite drill? Do you have a favorite drill that you ran every day, or a favorite that your girls liked the best?
My favorite was probably, I got it from Judy Spolstra, defense wins drill. Was a, you put 12 kids, three teams of four, and you just, your coaches were outlets, but, and, you know, you scored by holding, holding them defensively, and just the idea of defense wins, and had to get a rebound, you outlet it, and then to one of the coaches, and then the other team rotated in. So you had to really pay attention, and you had to close out quickly. It was kind of the end of the defense. We broke everything down, and then that was it. And it's a pretty intense drill that I enjoyed, and I think I changed a little bit, but I used to go to a lot of college practices and watch, and Judy did that one. But we had probably the kids' favorite drill was no rules. It was sometimes how we'd end practice. We just do a continuous fast break drill, but there were no rules. And it sometimes got out of hand, but, you didn't have to dribble. You didn't have to, to do any. There were no rules, and they just laughed. And it was a good way, if you're having a long week, and they had fun. So yeah. I thought that was good every once in a while.
Yeah.
But they would have done that all day if I let them, so.
Yeah, no kidding. I think I got one more for you here, Coach, which is really just, what advice would you have for coaches in season? One of the things that we're facing in our profession, and I'm sure you saw it as AD, whether at CV or other schools, is just coaches burning out, right, just getting tired and not wanting to do it anymore. So what advice would you have for coaches, young and old, to kind of keep them fresh during the season? What maybe did you do to keep yourself from burning out and kept you going?
Well, that's a tough question, because I think for me, and it's part of the reason I did get out a couple times, and part of it was to recharge. And if you're at that point, I mean, just to get out doesn't mean you're out permanently. And I think another thing is maybe look at a different role. Like Dan Vanelli was a longtime assistant, and Brian Wake both were head coaches, and I think they went back as assistants and really enjoyed that role more. Just to look at it, because it's really worth it. I think it's the, to me, it's the ultimate teaching. You're doing something with kids, or you're in the, you have this same thing that you're working with them. And so it's, I think if you enjoy teaching, you can really enjoy coaching, because it is such a cooperative environment, hopefully, that you're doing this together.
Yeah.
That's a tough question, though.
Yeah. Yeah. How about, I'm sure you're aware, obviously you retired, but probably still keeping an eye on things. We're about to start, hopefully, in May, kind of the weirdest basketball season in OSAA history. Limited practice time, shortened season. Any advice you have for coaches? How should we pare things down? Any ideas?
Yeah, that's so unique. And I think it's just to keep in mind that it's the case for everyone. And then I know for me, I would just try to keep it really simple. you're talking about those things earlier, I just feel like you're going to be so limited that it would be so frustrating to not do anything well
right.
if you're trying to put everything in. So just to keep it simple and run a few things well is really probably the only choice you have. That would be what I tell my coaches for sure, you know, just to do that. So, and make it as enjoyable. I think people are going to enjoy it just because they're so hungry for it now. I mean, I can hardly wait to go to a high school game again just to watch.
Right. Yeah.
So I can't imagine if I was coaching or if I was playing, just how excited I'd be just to get out there and play or coach. So.
Yeah. All right, Coach. That's all I have for you today. Thank you so much for sharing the game with us today. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. I really appreciate it. I think this is really great what you're doing.
If you have any follow-up questions or want to get a hold of Coach Ellingson, you can find his contact information in the episode description. We hope you'll join us next time here on the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Until then, coach them up.
Thank you for listening to the Oregon Basketball Coaches Podcast. Is there a coach you'd like to hear from or a topic you'd like to hear us discuss? You can write us a message on the Anchor website or send us an email at OregonBasketballCoaches@gmail.com. You can also subscribe to this podcast on Spotify.